All the wayward wind.
Good morning and welcome to our second show on Downtown Crossword Road. Sorry. We're really honored to have Jan Perry with us this morning, the former councilwoman for the 9th District and candidate for mayor. And Jan's currently the general manager of economic development and workforce development for the new administration of Eric Garcetti. Good morning, Jan.
Hey, Ed, how are you? It's good to be here.
Thank you. We're really excited to have you. And I think I'll skip my general introduction of last week, where I cited certain issues in the city, in the county, and in the state. Well, the state's currently under a court order to reduce its prison population. We're struggling with that. We live in a city that might face bankruptcy, depending on what happens with the pension funds. And here we're struggling with different identity issues downtown, and you're just the perfect person to talk to.
I know you're. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You know, people know you, but they don't know much about you and where you grew up, and that how affects the feeling you have for the city. Can you tell us about growing up in L.A. when you did?
Well, I didn't grow up in Los Angeles. I grew up in the Midwest, and I came here in 1974 to go to college at USC, and I just never left. I fell in love with the weather, but what has always fascinated me is the growth of a city and how a city defines itself. And I enjoyed my time at USC very much because we were right in the midst of the city, between South Los Angeles and the growth of downtown Los Angeles. And so I've been able to be intimately involved with those two worlds merging since the 1970s.
Fantastic. What was going on? Where did you grow up in LA exactly?
I didn't grow up in Los Angeles.
No, once you got here.
Oh, all right. Well,
How old were you?
I was 19, 20. Spent all my time living in and around the campus for quite a while. I went to graduate school at USC, so, I lived in and around that area probably all the way through the 1980s.
Okay, and then where did you develop your attraction for South Los Angeles?
Well, you know, I was my parents were both community-minded people. They were both in politics back where I grew up. And so we always spent lots of time, you know, helping people, helping families, because that's what they taught us to do. So when I came here to Los Angeles, I immediately plunged myself into a program called the Joint Educational Project, and I tutored youngsters after school and helped them with their homework at 28th Street Elementary School. And that was my first very deep connection with children and their families in the neighborhood, in the community. And I loved it very much, and I just wanted to continue to do that.
Right, let's backtrack a little. What was it like to grow up in the Midwest?
Well, it's different. Different in some ways and then not. You know, I think anytime you are in a big city in the United States, there's a lot of similarities. You know, people need jobs, people need housing, people are grappling with the issues of mental illness and homelessness. Transportation systems always need to be built. And the challenge is to, you know, make sure that a city grows forward so that young people will stay and not leave. And they are always building for the future. So I think, and then looking back at my time in and around the Cleveland area, and how their economy is struggling now, it's possible that they didn't change fast enough to keep young people there and give people places to work, change their economies to adopt more contemporary market changes, so the people who were in the industrial jobs and the assemblage jobs were able to convert to higher tech jobs. I think that's one thing we here in Los Angeles are doing right.
How's that?
Well, I think
our... Can you elaborate, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we are much more mindful of market shifts, career opportunities that didn't exist 20 years ago, and have a willingness to not only work with startup companies, to incubate opportunities, to work with our academic institutions, to make sure that young people in our community colleges are trained for jobs that are emerging, even in biomed or in solar energy or in green energy jobs or in digital, high-tech digital opportunities, fiber optics, those kinds of things.
I know you were somewhat involved with LA Trade Tech and what went on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was really wonderful, and I intend to keep working with Trade Tech and all of the other, now that I'm functioning on a citywide basis, with all of the community colleges, LACC, Southwest Valley College, to focus on their best practices on how they are preparing their students for the greatest opportunities in their geographic area, and to create opportunities to make sure those students are being placed in jobs that will give them a career path.
Can you tell us how you involved that principal? Very important to create these well-paying jobs for young people. Mm-hmm. In some of the projects you did in South L.A.?
Sure. Well, you know, you, first of all, you look at a geographic area where the people live, and you say, what's in this area? What's within, you know, 10 minutes by bus or 20 minutes by bike or, you know, say 15 minutes by car? And what's coming? What are you building? What direction is the construction and the building going? Is it heading south? Bringing it closer to the people where they live. Then you work with the developers and you try to provide them with incentives so that they will go and build in areas that need to be transitioned. And hopefully you get developers who are willing to be receptive to the issue of hiring people from communities. And then if you're fortunate, like I was many, many times, I did a number of project labor agreements which had language in them to hire people who were not only from lower income areas, but to hire people who were returning from prison, people who were homeless, and vets, and people who might not normally get caught in that net, to make sure that we gave people opportunity across the board to go back to work.
That's fantastic. Was that involved in your supermarket projects? You brought several markets to South Los Angeles. When you made those agreements, yes. Was it with the market or was these construction-related jobs?
Both. In the case of the two new supermarkets on Central Avenue, we had agreements with the owners to hire locally and to work with the local nonprofits in the area that did job training and job readiness, and, you know, open it up to the general community too, so that people who could basically walk to work had the opportunity to apply for these jobs.
Fantastic. And I understand there might have been a little more difficulty had you tried to bring the larger markets into those areas. Is that accurate? I've already made a couple of mistakes in this interview, so I don't want to make that a third.
No, you haven't made any mistakes. I think that the grocery stores that have come in thus far south of Washington Boulevard have been independent grocery stores. Of course, it'd be wonderful to have chain stores because there still continues to be a significant need for full-service grocery stores in South Los Angeles.
Why is that?
Why is that? Is there a need?
What is the cause? Why do you think we still don't have enough of the well-known markets in South L.A.?
Well, I think there's a certain bias that needs to be overcome. This is a market of people, a buyer's market. People need to eat. They are very interested in having healthy food options, not only for themselves, but for their children and their families. I remember the first day we opened the market at 20th and Central, and I drove up. I was coming from City Hall, so I had to drive over, and I pulled in the parking lot, and I didn't see a lot of cars. And at first I was crestfallen, and then I realized, as I looked around the corner, and I saw 800 people standing in line just to get in, these folks had walked or taken the bus.
That must have been a great feeling.
It was overwhelming. It was overwhelming because it just demonstrates the desire and the need and the interest and the willingness to buy healthy food when it's, you know, provided to you in your own community.
Can you elaborate on the types of jobs that were created right on that one project that you're talking about?
Well, yeah. Just for example, in a grocery store, you then have a situation where you have a career path. You have unskilled opportunities like loading and unloading the trucks. And, you know, you can go up as high as a manager or a management position. So the, you know, cashiers, high-skilled job, you know, stocking, working in logistics and goods movement. So there's a broad opportunity for people to come into an organization like that and work their way up.
Fantastic. How about in construction? Were you able to influence any jobs in the building of the project?
Well, not only in the building of the project, and, you know, again, we had a local hire agreement. Any project that has city money in it or public funds in it, we can usually compel a developer to engage in a local hire agreement. And most people feel pretty good about it. I got to tell you, there were in very few instances did I meet someone who didn't think that hiring local was not a good idea. Most people were very pleased to be able to do that.
So did they hire local? Is there any wage agreement that it has to be union standard wages, or is that separate?
Well, when a developer receives city money or, you know, public money, they are obligated to pay a living wage.
Okay. Just want to remind all listeners that the show Downtown Crossroads will be available on iTunes. And if you're really enjoying our guests and our questions, you should subscribe on iTunes to the show. I want to just go back to something else for a minute. You know, one reason I thought you grew up here is you've been so involved in the redevelopment of Central Avenue in so many ways. Can you tell us the basis of that attraction for you?
Well, you know, I said earlier, you go to any great American city and there's always a core to a community. My father was the head of an economic development corporation in a neighborhood called Huff in Cleveland. That was a lot like South Los Angeles. So growing up, I watched him do what he did to redevelop the community. I grew up hearing about Central Avenue being the center, the birthplace, the heartbeat for jazz on the West Coast. So when I got here, you know, it was like seeing a dream come true. And when I was elected as councilwoman, I wanted to give people back their history. Dunbar Hotel is the epicenter for that. So, you know, I set about restoring the Dunbar Hotel very early on, and it was a rocky road. But we finally found the right combination of a developer and a nonprofit and the funding. And so now the Dunbar Hotel has been completely and fully restored. It looks absolutely beautiful.
Fantastic. So what's its use now?
It is a residence for people who are 55 years and older.
Wow, that's a good way to integrate a historical issue with a housing need.
Absolutely.
Have you done other projects like that?
Oh, I've done a lot of projects like that. You know, before the end of my term, we added up everything that I had worked on for the last 12 years. And I knew that I had done about 5,000 units of either mixed income, affordable, or permanent supportive housing. It was actually 5,600 new units that I've worked on. So, you know, I've been involved not only in creating a lot of housing in Skid Row, but a lot in South Los Angeles.
Right. No, I'm aware of that. Did any of them combine a historic motive like the Dunbar Hotel with the housing need?
Well, you know, we've taken some older buildings and then repurposed them. I mean, the St. George is one of them. And that's a beautiful building, and it has solar panels on the roof so that they can save on energy and put it back into programming for their clients. There's the Yankee over in Skid Row, again, a repurposed building. So I did a lot of new construction and a lot of repurposed buildings.
There was a bit of confusion amongst the developers downtown when they thought you were supporting the changes in the area around Spring and Main over to, I guess you might call it gentrification, but you pretty much stuck to your guns on different issues revolving the SRO hotels mm-hmm. and made sure that really wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. What was the basis of that, and how do you feel about those decisions that were made about the SRO hotels under your regime in the 9th District?
Regime is so militaristic.
It does sound a little, I'm just was searching for a word.
Yeah. I feel good. I always give a lot of thought to, you know, my public policy and how I evolve and develop. And I felt that it was important that downtowns can provide a seat at the table for everyone. A downtown can be economically diverse as well as ethnically and socially diverse. These single-room occupancy hotels were large and in great disrepair. And when the opportunity presented itself to restore them and to renovate them so that we could make sure that as a city, we provided a base level of affordable housing, I jumped at that opportunity.
Do you think it's possible to keep a balance in what we call Skid Row, we're supposed to now call it the historic area, between those people and people like them that really needed help, need lower cost housing, and at the same time encourage development in our area?
Yes, I think you could keep a balance. And I think there's two factors that you need to look for in whatever project is built for permanent supportive housing for people who are formerly homeless. Number one is the design of the project and whether the design is oriented towards recovery and providing stability. And two, the organization that operates the building and that they are a strong, viable operator with a very hands-on approach to managing its client base. A couple of places come to mind. Downtown Women's Center is one of them. Skid Row Housing Trust is another. And SRO Housing, all top-notch organizations for the development, management of housing, and the attention that they give to their clients.
You know, you should tell us a little bit more about that, the Downtown Women's Center. That's a wonderful, well-respected project.
Well, you know, you asked me earlier about any buildings that were historic that we repurposed. There's a perfect example. That was a 1920s high-rise in its day. And over the years, it had probably housed some sweatshops and light assemblage. And then as soon as I got elected, we started working with the Downtown Women's Center and Lisa Watson to be able to convey that building to that organization, because they do such an extraordinary job of helping their clients recover. And so once we were able to convey it to them, and that took quite a while to be able to do that, that was a forgiveness of a federal loan, they went on to raise, I believe, over $30 million to do the restoration of the building. And now, I can't remember the number of beds, but I think it's well over 70, and then they have a very active day program. They have medical services on site and mental health services on site. And the rooms are beautiful. And it's a safe place for these ladies to be.
Do women and children need separate facilities from the male population in order to be successful?
Well, some women, in fact, prefer it. I've seen that with DWC, and I've also seen it with the emergency shelter that I started down on Broadway and 38th Street. And many women have been victims of domestic violence or just violence, period. And so in order for them to recover, they need to be in an environment that doesn't always include men, or at least when they're sleeping, to be separated from the men. So, you know, given their life experience, that's what they want.
You mentioned the Skid Row Housing Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know them, and they do a great job. Some people might say it's a little expensive. The new facility they built near Hope in Venice,
mm-hmm.
which it's a beautiful-looking building, but they themselves will admit it costs about $300,000 a unit to provide the housing and other services which they offer in that facility.
Right.
When people hear a number like that, which is like equal to the cost of maybe a new condominium, not in the best neighborhoods mm-hmm. in Los Angeles, but in a half-decent area,
mm-hmm.
some people really question that figure and say, oh my God, how could you spend that much money on someone who hasn't adapted to society? What do you think about those numbers? Can they be reduced? And what if they can't?
I think you have to be realistic. And, you know, for people who question those numbers, I suggest that they look at the number of people who are on the street up near Vera Street, even in Skid Row, and the amount of resources that go to leaving people in the street versus having them go into housing that is supported, that has support services on site, that has a greater likelihood that they will recover and not end up back on the street, and cause law enforcement to be the de facto mental health provider, because folks who are on the street have no safety net. So in my opinion, it is money well spent. Obviously, you have to look at the pro forma of any project to make sure that it pencils out. As for cost per unit, you know, I've done some interesting projects where I'm actually mixed. At the restored YMCA just off of Central Avenue and Stanford on 28th Street, some units for people who are formerly homeless with transitional age youth and market rate. The more you mix up the various streams of revenue, the greater the sustainability of the building over the long term.
I happen to agree with that. Now, some would argue that the city has no business forcing affordable units into market rate projects as they're required west of the freeway, Central City West.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling about that? Do you think these market rate projects that have an affordable component are hindered somehow, or they benefit from it?
For any developer who comes in and asks for city money or public money, you know, there is an expectation that they will provide some affordable units. We have a shortage of housing for people at all income levels. Now, if a developer comes in and just pulls a permit and builds a building by right, then obviously they can do whatever they want. That's market rate. And they have no obligation. But if they're taking public money, there is a need to leverage that opportunity to be able to house people at different levels of affordability.
Now, I know Jeffrey Palmer, one of the major developers in the city, he took that Central City West zoning requirement mm-hmm. all the way to the Supreme Court and won
mm-hmm.
that you cannot require a developer to put in an affordable component mm-hmm. without compensation.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Mr. Palmer's thinking has evolved. He worked on a project with me over on 23rd and Flower, and it's going to be an extraordinary project. He signed a community benefits agreement that creates long-term benefits to the surrounding South Los Angeles community, and there are a number of affordable units in the project. It's right next to a rail line.
Right.
And I think his project will not only stand the test of time, it's going to turn people's perception in another direction. Now, if he can do it, I think anybody can do it.
Well said. I go by that project because mm-hmm. I take the train downtown.
Right.
Now that I have my tap card.
Yes.
And We just want to explain to our listeners that we're talking about one of the largest developers in the city. And Jan just brought up his new project, which is Mammoth, right on the train line. And I'm glad to hear that they had that modification.
Yeah, it's exciting. And, you know, I would venture to say that he realized being next to the transportation line, that he was more forward thinking. And it's exciting to stand there on the platform and see people get on and off of the train with their bikes and to see young people walking to and from Trade Tech with their book bags. And when that housing opens up, that I predict is going to be one of the busiest stops on that line.
Thank you. You know, he's also planning a project with L&R by 9th and Main and Olympic and Los Angeles Street. Do you know if there's anything in the offing there as far as affordability?
No, I don't know.
No problem. You know, we keep mentioning the public funding and using the public funding as a way to create an incentive for developers. Do you see that being impacted by what they call the new normal, which is this ongoing financial crisis? And if so, is there an alternative to public funding to get developers, which are all my clients are developers, to contribute to the public good without public financial incentives?
Well, again, you have to be realistic. People don't go into development because, you know, they are social workers. They go into it because they're there to make money, or they're there to make a profit. You know, now these nonprofits, they're doing development of housing for other reasons, where they're targeting populations, people who are at risk, people who are mentally ill, people who need stability in their lives. So you have to understand who you're dealing with. You know, we lost the redevelopment agency, so we don't have property tax revenue or tax increment to offer up anymore. There are still tax credit opportunities at the state level. The governor's dissolving the state enterprise zones. And so that takes away another potential development tool. There is some legislation on the federal level that allows foreign investors to come in with a minimum of $500,000 with a promise of, you know, hiring locally in exchange for expedited immigration assistance and that sort of thing. But we're going to have to try harder and push harder. It's going to be more difficult.
Thank you. You were involved in some incredible projects in your tenure as a council person in the 9th District. And we want to explain to our listeners that the 9th District at that point included downtown and a lot of South Los Angeles. And you put in the first urban wetlands.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that? I found that to be incredible. And as you know, I went to the opening.
Yeah, there's two. First one is at Slauson and Compton. Now, the park was already built, but I wanted to add the wetlands in. So when I got elected, I added in a wetlands. It's 2 to 3 acres, depending on the water level at Slauson and Compton. You can go down there and see all sorts of migratory birds down there and some little animals that I think aren't indigenous, but that's okay. There's a lot of turtles in there now.
Wow.
And some goldfish. But I loved it so much. There was a former MTA bus yard at 54th and Avalon. That's a 10-acre site. So I worked with sanitation and wastewater management in the city of Los Angeles, and we got some Proposition O money and some other funding sources and converted this concrete hot spot into a 10-acre wetlands. And so now we have shorebirds down there. There's bridges. There's walking trails. We're putting the utilities underground. There's a pocket park. It's across the street from a learning communities high school, around the corner from a junior high school. And I hope to be able to raise money over time, even though I'm no longer the council person for the area, to restore the historic poured concrete building that's on site there so that that can be used as a community gathering spot.
Did you have to get the cooperation of different levels of government?
Yes.
You know, a lot of our listeners don't understand jurisdictional issues in Los Angeles. There's so many overlapping jurisdictions that you have to deal with.
Yeah.
What was that like in this wetlands project?
It was really complicated. Dealing with the MTA was very complex. And
that's the Metropolitan Transit Association.
Yeah, thank you.
Authority,
say,
sorry.
Abbreviations or in acronyms. Yeah, that was hard. And you have to be very tenacious and very patient and just, you know, dig in and keep going till you get to where you need to be. And working with the federal government, of course, state, some state money, and our own Proposition O clean water bond money. So you have to hit it on all fronts.
Has a lot of that funding been cut back with the new normal?
No.
No.
No, it's a different type of funding. No, but, you know, you have to be competitive. And you have to be committed to pursuing a project and its funding source until you accomplish your objective.
Tough job. Sounds like an escrow, but 10 times
it's
worse.
It's worse than an escrow.
You know, you also were involved in another gorgeous park that everyone is loving downtown, Grand Hope Park.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what was that like to be involved in that project and the different governmental levels, and also to be working with a gigantic developer and have the park be just one aspect of what they were planning?
Well, I got to give credit to where credit is due. I was on the Joint Powers Authority with Supervisor Gloria Molina for 10 years, and it was Supervisor Molina who said to the developer related that you will put the money for the park up front. And, you know, I don't know if she was psychic or just visionary, but, you know, the market, the bubble burst, the market went in a downward trend. But they had already put their park money, over $50 million, into escrow with the county. So regardless of what happened with the real estate market, the park got built. And I knew that we all realized that the park would be extraordinary and that, you know, Los Angeles longed for its own large public gathering space. But this park has been the site of some tremendous programs already.
It's a wonderful gathering area for children from all different backgrounds.
Right.
Play around there. And
well, especially at the water feature.
Right.
Which is, you know, low level of water. Anybody can go in there. I know I've been in there a few times.
Wow. Well, don't worry, I won't report you.
That's okay. It's all right.
Gloria Molina was also involved in a major struggle over the homeless in the L.A. Basin. I believe she wanted to establish of facilities throughout the county and was stymied in that effort. Now, can you tell us about the needs of the homeless in Los Angeles and whether or not they can be handled in downtown alone, or do we really need to look at regional centers throughout the LA Basin in order to really take care of the homeless issue and homeless people, many of whom are vets and older women that you see living on the street? What kind of an approach should we take, and can downtown really handle it? Or do we need to follow what Gloria Molina was suggesting?
Supervisor Molina was, again, way ahead of her thinking. She's way ahead of everybody else in her thinking.
Right.
And I think what would best explain is that, you know, you treat people in the communities from which they come. Skid Row is kind of a rough place, not necessarily a place for women and children. And it's always better to provide people with service, support, recovery, housing in the communities from which they originated. The city and the county have developed much stronger, more clearly drawn relationships over the last 10 to 12 years, in large part due to her interest, her willingness, and commitment to pursue that. And I think we need to continue in that vein. And no, downtown cannot be the answer to the region's problem of homelessness.
I understand that the Board of Supervisors, which listeners might not know, is the ruling entity in L.A. County, may not necessarily agree with her about the direction to take. You think there's been any change in that? Is there an openness?
You know, I to the extent that I've shared my thoughts with you on that, that's
about it.
That's about it. I do know that it's important for the county to coordinate with the city because basically homelessness has no boundaries.
Certainly true.
And the county provides mental health and public health money. The city builds the housing. Different responsibilities, but ones that complement each other.
Looking forward to your new position as the General Manager of Economic and Workforce Development mm-hmm. under the new administration.
Yeah.
Will you be able to take parts of your experience that you consider valuable and apply that in your new job?
Yes. Yes. I've already started my new job. I think I'm in my third week. And yes, I will. I have. I've already been approached from a number of people with whom I had done business in the past, who are very interested in what this new department is going to do. And it is my charge to get the new department ready, prepared, and ready to roll. And a lot of the functions that used to be done by the Community Development Department will be rolled over to the Housing Department, particularly those that had more of a social service bent. And we will focus much more on workforce development, not only for young people, but for adults, to be able to provide people who are job ready to, you know, put right into the projects that we hope to develop and to make sure that we have a steady stream of projects coming into the city of Los Angeles and that people find it much more straightforward to be able to do business with the city of Los Angeles.
It seems there was some improvement in that direction and maybe it slowed down.
Well, I think it slowed down because the market slowed down, you know. I mean, my view has always been that when the market slows down, that's a chance to catch up. But, you know, we have to change our mindset in government. Government always lags behind the private sector in recovery. And when the private sector is recovering again, we should be able to look at that as an opportunity for us to catch up because we've been given a respite. It's not a time to relax. It's a time to refocus, redefine, retool, and get ready for the next wave.
Fantastic. Are there new sources of funding for the projects you're talking about that you're anticipating under the Garcetti administration?
I'm not anticipating any new sources of funding for public money. What I am anticipating is more creativity and innovation in developing relationships between the public sector, between the city, nonprofits, and private dollars.
And, you know, in the last mayoral election, one of the issues was the losing candidate had ran as a major supporter of the unions. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts of any kind in terms of what the proper relationship is between public sector and public employee unions. And if you could distinguish between that and the relationship with construction unions. I know you've had good relationships in construction, and they've been very supportive of a lot of projects that you're involved with.
I look at development as it's a reflection of our economy, and there's a continuum, and everybody has a chance to be on that continuum. You know, we start off with the concept, the developer, the site control, and then we go to jobs, then the construction. If they're public money, then the construction trades, they come in. Even if not, they can still come in. Either way, it's a chance to put people back to work. Ultimately, there has to be a balance and an opportunity. One side of the equation cannot exist without the other.
What about the difference between dealing with the public employee unions and the construction unions? Do you have any reflections on that?
I think everybody's motivated by the economy, and they may come at it from different perspectives, but I think that's what drives anyone if they're trying to, you know, look out for their members, put their members back to work, you know, contain their health care costs or whatever that might be. What is important, I think, to the from the outside perspective is your public servant has to have that level of independence to weigh all those factors and to do what is absolutely best for the employment of people, the recovery of a community and a city, and bringing in net new revenue so that we can continue to survive. You know, I tell you, this Detroit bankruptcy is a cautionary tale for any large American city, and that we should all be watching and reading about it every single day.
I take it that you may be alluding to issues with the pension funds in Detroit, because
well,
the economy is very different.
Well, I'm not alluding to just that. It all sort of devolves into the quality of leadership. If you do extensive reading on what happened to Detroit and what's been happening to Detroit over the last 20, 30 years, one of the recurrent themes is leadership. And leadership on behalf of people, decision-making on behalf of people versus leadership without accountability. Leadership that may have been for the benefit of the leader and not for the benefit of the people that the leader was elected to serve.
Fantastic. What are some of the things that stop public sector leaders from really acting in the interest of the public?
There's nothing that stops one other than a personal decision.
To
either act on behalf of the community or to act on behalf of oneself and their own long-term personal gain. This is what term limits has wrought, because the public has become more disengaged, as noted by an even lower voter turnout. And, you know, they may or may not know who represents them. They may not necessarily understand what they do. And there may not be the oversight, you know, from the public, from the media. And by the time people figure it out, a person has gone on to their next political office.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. Some people believe that term limits, rather than serve a public purpose, serve a private purpose, in that the only people that have a long-term stake in office are the lobbyists and consultants. Is that one of the issues?
That's one of the byproducts. I think that's one of the unintended consequences, that lobbyists and people who are long-term members of bureaucracy are the only ones with any institutional memory.
What do you think should be done with the situation of the budget in Los Angeles and the ongoing debt? Some people say it's mainly the pension funds.
I think we have to be very mindful of that. Again, look at a city like Detroit. We have to learn from that. And if they're not able to, you know, sell their bonds on the open market, that could have implications for cities across this country. That's why we need to pay attention to it. So it's not just a matter of having a debate about, you know, pension costs. It's a matter of what the bond agencies, how they perceive the sale of those bonds and whether or not they're successful, because their recovery and success is a reflection on cities across the country. But I think it's important to teach the ratepayers about, you know, what comprises the general fund, what's allocated towards, you know, sanitation and street cleaning, tree trimming, you know, street paving, and that, you know, as we vote on it, or a body votes on it, how they prioritize, you know, and how this translates into affecting your life on a daily basis.
Do you think LA suffers from what one calls a weak mayor system, where the power seems to be concentrated in the city council?
I think a mayor is in a unique situation. I think this mayor is in a very unique situation. Not only is he very bright, not only is he strong in policy and is very strategic in his thinking, I think that he will be able to implement strategies to directly address transportation issues in a very hands-on way. He has a high level of interest, a very keen interest in putting people back to work and merging them with projects that he intends to bring here in the city to bring in net new revenue into our general fund. So I think he's very mindful of those issues.
Okay. Thanks so much. We have a little more time. Is there anything that you see in the future as far as the urban development and what's happening downtown that you'd like people to know about?
Well, you know, I think it's very important to pay attention to what 20-year-olds have to say. I have a 20-some-year-old daughter, and I spend hours asking her questions about what she thinks, how she thinks, you know, watching some of the television shows that she watches. It gives me some insight into the direction the city is headed. I was struck by a comment one of her friends said after they came back from New York, and they said, you know, New York's a very expensive city, but, you know, there's so many things there for young people to do, and it's so easy to get around. You never need a car there, and I don't want to spend money on a car. I want to spend money on, you know, experiences. And in reading some of these articles about, you know, millennials, as if you will, you know, they have to struggle with not creating a social life through social media, but actually getting out there and seeing people, but they don't drive as much. And they're not interested in buying cars. So we have to provide them with that backbone, that spine or skeleton for them to be able to navigate this city and get around and to take full advantage of the cultural opportunities and the work opportunities that are rightfully theirs.
It's kind of the reverse of Back to the Future, which was filmed in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And these kids want nothing to do with the suburbs and the long drives. They really like the urban areas.
They want to be in the middle of things. You know, this weekend, I think it's this weekend, the National Dance Day is coming up, and they'll be over there at the plaza in front of the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and I'm hoping that it'll spill over into Grand Park. But I'm expecting that there will be thousands of people, and a lot of them will be young people looking for opportunity. And, you know, there's a portal right there for the Red Line. And I'm expecting to see a lot of people taking public transportation to come down and just interact with each other and be with each other.
Yeah, I think I saw some of that Saturday night. We went to grand performances. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those people use the MTA to get there, use the train.
That's great.
And they took advantage of a free concert. It was wonderful.
It's grand performance. This is all about that.
It was a lot of fun. You know, do you think L.A. suffers from NIMBYism, where there was so much opposition to putting in the Red Line and extending it west, and now there's opposition to the Exposition Line? And, you know, in a lot of these areas, it's kind of annoying. You can't even park in a lot of places in West L.A., never mind putting in a homeless facility. Are we unique in that we're really into not in my backyard in Los Angeles?
No, I don't think we're unique. I think we're like a lot of cities that are going through change, that are in flux. But I think we can be unique if we can be extraordinarily patient with people. I remember a fellow I was talking to when I was working on the first phase of the Expo Line, and he lived over on the west side, and he was very opposed to it. And, you know, they spent a lot of time with him and the folks in his immediate community on the stop, the landscaping, the lighting, the public art, putting in bike paths and making it very, very green. And I saw him not too long ago at a private gathering, and, you know, he brought it up to me. He said, well, you know, we worked it out. And he was pretty angry when I first saw him. And he said, you know, I'm not entirely thrilled, but I'm okay with it. And to me, that's progress. That's the kind of progress we can make here. Just hang in here with each other and keep working at it until we can move people forward. Because if you really want to overcome the traffic issue, one of the biggest dents we can make is to have this line extended and finish it, have it look good, have it be sustainable. I'm excited. You know, the thought of being able to get on the blue line, go south to the Expo Line, and take it all the way over to Santa Monica and, you know, to do what I want without having a car. That's so exciting. I can hardly wait.
Yeah, I don't blame you for being so excited. I take the buses and they're packed with people that mm-hmm. love doing it. And then the train is getting used more and more often, that mm-hmm. Expo Line and the Red Line. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting. It's kind of like New York.
Right, it is. It's fun.
Makes you feel you're in a grown-up city.
That's right.
No, I just want to return for a minute to the issue of downtown. There's a lot of young people that are happy to move downtown. And as you know, the more people we have living downtown, the less we have to overdevelop the suburbs and the less we have to interfere with whatever environment, natural environment we really have left.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems is just not all these young women who are a big part of our workforce and a big part of the future and want to raise families can handle downtown. It's like a split down the middle. You talk to one and they could care less. They're thrilled to be here. Spring Street is filled up with mm-hmm. so many young people at night.
Right.
But there's a significant number that are genuinely afraid of certain members of the homeless community.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself, you know, I'm a downtowner and I've been attacked 3 times downtown.
Right.
And it's very unpleasant,
yeah,
to say the least. And I'm just wondering, do the homeless themselves downtown and LA CAN and organizations, do they owe a responsibility to the rest of the community to behave in a certain way, or are they exempt and we should
Nobody's
expect
exempt.
Nothing?
People should always treat each other with respect. But there should be some recognition that there are people who are on the street who are suffering from mental illness. I don't believe they should be on the street. I believe they should be in housing. And when I was in office, I focused heavily on making sure that we built as much housing as possible to pull people in off of the street and into recovery. One of the projects I worked on over the St. George, those folks came directly from the street into housing. So I think it's very important to continue to do that. And, you know, people need to have situational awareness, no matter who or where they are. Whether they're a parent or a single person or man or woman, you should be aware. A city's a city. And there are always things that are going to happen. And it's not always going to be pleasant. But, you know, we choose to live here for a number of reasons. To have another kind of experience, to be closer to cultural facilities. Downtown's changing their schools down here more now than ever. More facilities for families. There's grocery stores, cleaners, things like that. So you could actually live a life with a family here and have a pretty full and rich life. But it, you know, it is an urban setting.
There's certain streets at night that even now are empty out of, people aren't comfortable walking there. Do you think that's going to change in the near future?
Well, you'd have to give me the streets you're talking about, and I'll tell you whether or not I think they'll change in the near future.
Even parts of 7th Street, when you leave Bottego Louie and uh-huh. walk more towards my area,
yeah.
when you walk east, there's a curtain, couple blocks there
yeah.
that young women, and especially women with children, would not want to walk on in the evening.
Well, there's a lot of panhandling going on as you go further east.
Okay.
And that's still the case. And that has to do with the local leadership, of course, and working with the local police department and maybe the BID, the Business Improvement District, to give people a sense of security, knowing that there are eyes and feet on the street, looking out for people's well-being.
Thank you. You mentioned the BIDs. Now, I've been involved with these Business Improvement Districts almost from the beginning. There's been a recent court decision as a result of a lawsuit filed in the Toy District
mm-hmm.
that really threatens the very existence of the BIDs mm-hmm. downtown. What do you think about that? How important is it that these business improvement districts stay alive and are allowed to continue the job they've been doing all these years?
I remember a time, as I worked with the city for many, many years, when we didn't have business improvement districts. We did not have the capacity to be able to keep up with the clean and safe issues, and the Toy District really was overrun. The loss of this Business Improvement District over in the Toy District remains to be seen, the impacts of that. But I can say that it doesn't portend for anything positive. I think Business Improvement Districts need to continue to exist because local government will continue to downsize.
Right. What do you think? What's a good answer to landlords that have money but just don't want to pay the cost of maintaining the BID? How can they be made to understand?
I would say that you need to live in reality and that your local government will continue to downsize. Services need to be provided. A city will still be able to provide a baseline of services, but in order for you to grow your area, to market your area, to secure your area to the level that you feel that needs to be secured, which may be above and beyond what LAPD could provide for you, the Business Improvement District is your answer in a way to develop your own community and self-governance.
Fantastic. What about the situation in, you know, you ride around our city, and if you go in these alleys behind the buildings, it's astounding the state of disrepair and the fact that it's like riding a roller coaster when you go down an alley in this town, all over.
West you mean because Hollywood, they're not paved?
They're not paved. They're not maintained at all. What is that? What happened to our cities so that they can't even afford to maintain? Those are public rights of way.
Well, you're looking at a priority, you know, and you when you have shrinking resources, then you see choices being made. I'll pave the street and fix the sidewalk before I fix the alley. But what you need in your area, your respective areas, is somebody who is your local elected official who manages the area as if it's a portfolio. And, you know, you move through the infrastructure needs, prioritize them, make sure they get done.
Thank you. But what happened to our society that all of a sudden in the 80s, the cities couldn't afford to maintain the infrastructure and they had to turn to the landlords and create these BIDs?
Well, it's a lot of things. And I think you'll remember some of them. I mean, Proposition 13 changed things radically. And you remember when that came into place. Loss of revenue. People leaving the cities. It's only in the last, 15 to 20 years that people decided to come back into the cities and to actually live near where they work. It's only been in the last, decade that we finally made that huge leap or bump into moving forward on our transportation systems to get people out of their cars. So we are reversing the effects of suburban sprawl and going in the other direction now.
Thank you. You know, I think Mayor Bradley is not remembered well enough. He's the one who really initiated all of this mass transit in the city.
Yeah, he did.
He doesn't get enough credit for that.
Well, you know, we have to tell people. That's our obligation.
Why is that? That unless a politician really works to establish his legacy, everyone just forgets about it?
I don't know. I think people just live their lives. And, you know, if they get what they need, then they're happy and they don't really think about where it came from. But Mayor Bradley is the individual who provided the baseline for almost everything you see. The transportation system, the skyline, his major proprietary departments, the development of the harbor, the airport. So, you know, he still resonates to this day.
What kind of a memory do you have of Gilbert Lindsay, another founding father of downtown?
I was a staff person. We used to have a cafeteria on the 10th floor. And I remember going to a luncheon for some little kids up there. And Mayor Bradley and Councilman Lindsay came in and sat with those kids for over an hour, sang camp songs with them, listened to their presentations, gave them applause. And, you know, I remember just sitting in the room thinking, gosh, you know, these are such important people. And yet they've taken time to be with these children and to really be engaged in what these kids are doing. And, you know, it's something I think about to this day.
Thank you.
Lindsay was a great guy.
He's amazing. Yeah, I have such great memories of both of them. And they all took a personal interest in me and everybody else.
They enjoyed people. They had a genuine curiosity about people.
Right. Well, you know, that's it for our show. We were so honored to have Jan Perry here, who is really on top of all of these issues. I'm even amazed at the answers she's given today. And our listeners should find our podcast on iTunes, Downtown Crossroads, and subscribe so that you'll be getting all of them. Some way down the road, we'll have a legacy program and we'll bring in people that know about Gil Lindsay and know about Mayor Tom Bradley.
holes